Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. To call in, we have a secure line ready. Area code 604-525-4167. Again, just call area code 604-525-4167. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. And now your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Black Op Radio. Our special edition, Black Op number 195, is on October 31st, 2004. And you're here in the control room with Leno Sanic, Anita Langley, and we're hoping, if everybody's patched through nicely, you've got Ed Haslam on the line.
Great, glad you could join us today.
All right, well, perhaps for those who don't know anything about you, who might be new to the JFK research community or even in the community for a while and not aware of your work, perhaps you could give us a little bit of personal background and introduce us to how you got going on the research you were on. And maybe we could just ask you also just to try and speak a little louder because we're not hearing you all that well.
Okay, well, I'm the author of a book called Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus. And this is a investigation into the death of Mary Sherman, who was a doctor in New Orleans, and the relationship that was reported that she had with David Ferry, who's a familiar name in JFK circles, and the claim published in Playboy magazine in 1967 that they were working with cancer-causing viruses on some sort of project in New Orleans. And that is, in a nutshell, what Mary Ferry and the monkey virus is about. I will start by saying I don't really consider myself a JFK researcher, but because so many of the names that came up when investigating Mary Sherman's murder, names like Lee Harvey Oswald, Guy Bannister, Alton Ochsner, David Ferry, it kind of forced me to become familiar more with the JFK subject in detail than I had been. However, having been from New Orleans and lived there during the 60s, I had sort of a front row seat on the Jim Garrison investigation into the JFK murder, which gave me some perspective, and I had some contacts there in town that gave me other information and perspectives, and notably this doctor who was murdered, who was a world-class cancer researcher, was a professor at Tulane Medical School where my father taught, and they both taught in the same department.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
So my father knew this woman who was murdered, and it was a very mysterious murder that is still officially unsolved, but most of the key information about the murder was hidden from public view for 30 years or so.
It's fair to say that your proximity to the murder was really what launched you into all this, because you were exposed to so much information, and I recall from reading your book the idea of monkey virus that sort of jumped out in your brain early on. Now, you had an interest in your father's research.
Well, it wasn't my father's research,
but it was the research
that the medical school was doing. And let me make a really clear point here, is that most people didn't even think about the subject of monkey viruses until the AIDS epidemic started. But prior to that, New Orleans, the medical community in New Orleans, was one of the world's leading research centers in the subject of monkey viruses. And they have the Delta Regional Primate Research Center down there, which is one of the federally funded monkey labs for doing this research. So what was going on in New Orleans by the early 1960s was very involved in monkey virus research. And Mary Sherman was a specialist in bone cancers, and she was a specialist in the use of radiation on these bone cancers. And she was a professor at the university, which is the host university of the government's monkey lab. Okay? So when you start putting those resources together, you wind up with a pretty volatile or dangerous situation. And then you turn around and discover that the investigation into the murder of the president has discovered that this political lunatic, David Ferry, is somehow connected with this doctor who's working at Tulane, and they're doing some kind of underground experiments to try to create cancer, and that they're using monkey viruses to do it. Now, looking at this from the perspective of 2004, where we are today, Halloween day of all days to be doing this, we have a much higher awareness of terrorism and bioterrorism and people with violent political agendas than we did back in the 60s. But these people had an underground medical laboratory that was using very sophisticated, very state-of-the-art knowledge and techniques to do something, and we know very little about it because even though it was mentioned in the national press, it didn't even get a follow-up question at the time.
Now, for those who don't know what happened to Mary Sherman, could you elaborate a little bit about her death and what actually happened? What actually triggered you to investigate this once that happened?
Well, let me start with the basics of the Mary Sherman murder. Mary Sherman was found dead in her apartment on July 21st, 1964. There was a small fire in her apartment that caused some smoke. The police showed up. The fire department showed up. They dragged the smoky mattress out, and they found the badly burned, severely burned body of a woman who had also been stabbed. What they did not tell the press or the public was the key piece of information, which was that her right arm was missing and had been burned off. Now, the problem with this whole scenario is it takes thousands of degrees to do damage like burn off an arm. You're talking about a major electrical event, like equivalent to being hit with a bolt of lightning. And there was nothing in Mary Sherman's apartment that could have possibly caused that damage. And so what you wind up with after a very detailed analysis, and that's why I wrote a book, frankly. There's so much to this story, the only way you can really present it is in a book. The basic point is Mary Sherman did not die in her apartment. She could not have. And I put the autopsy report in the book, and when you start to study that, you realize that some things happened to Mary Sherman before she died and some things happened afterwards. And particularly, there's one stab wound on her that killed her that was a precise, very carefully done puncture to her heart to kill her. And then there's all these wacko helter-skelter type reckless slash marks, all of which were done after she died. And those are to create that the whole thing of bringing her back to her apartment and creating the murder scene with the helter-skelter slashing and setting the fire, all that was to create some kind of tenuous explanation for the burns she had received earlier at another location. In other words, Mary Sherman was electrocuted somewhere up besides her apartment. Then she was terminated. You might call it a mercy killing because she already had her right arm burned off. She was already blind. She was basically a vegetable at that point, but the electricity had not crossed the heart. And in you talk to doctors who do these high-voltage electrocution work, and they will tell you that somebody can be really badly injured but not killed just because the electricity did not cross the heart. So somebody terminated her, then they brought her body back to the apartment, then they created this fake murder scene, set the fire, and left. And so what you had then was a cover-up story that got generated from there. For 30 years, nobody knew what happened to Mary Sherman because the police file was locked in the chief of police's desk. And they finally released it to the public library in New Orleans, and after 28 years after the murder, I got my hands on the police file and the autopsy and was able to sort out what happened to her.
Wow, that's pretty brutal. It sounds like she was tortured.
No, but she wasn't tortured. She was, it's more in the category of an electrical accident.
Oh.
But I do not believe that the accident was accidental. I think she was working on a piece of equipment that was a five megawatt linear particle accelerator that somebody sabotaged in order to create a problem for the people doing the work. And so what happened was 5 million volts of electricity came up her hand and went out her back right shoulder into a steel wall that had been built into this facility and had been grounded with steel cables in order to prevent the operators of this equipment from getting electrocuted or getting radiation from the equipment itself.
So then it sounds like her death was really more than anything coincidental to the whole JFK scenario, and that she was involved in a few things, and she just happened to be the lucky person who was, as you suggested, it was just to bring down a project.
Yes, well, if Dr. Alton Ochsner, who I believe was involved in this operation with her, and the purpose of all this equipment is something we need to get to fairly shortly here, but if Mary Sherman was a childless widow who was from out of town, they were able to drag her back to her apartment and create this story, and they set out all these rumors about lesbian butchers and stuff like that so everyone would stay away from it. But if somebody else, like Dr. Alton Ochsner, had grabbed that handle instead of Mary Sherman, they would have had a really hard time pulling off a cover story like that with the city's most prominent doctor. And when you realize, and back to the JFK thing for a second, I have right here in my library, right next to me, a phonograph album of the recordings of Lee Harvey Oswald's radio debate. And the reason I have that is that Dr. Alton Ochsner and his political action group called INCA actually published that album. And on the back of the album, there's a photograph of Dr. Ochsner. And it says that he was one of the only people who knew about Oswald's defection before that radio debate. Now, the question is, why is Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was the former president of the American Cancer Society and the founder and president of one of the largest regional medical centers in the United States, getting involved with, quote, a 24-year-old drifter in New Orleans named Lee Harvey Oswald? The day that Mary Sherman died, the Warren Commission came to New Orleans and started their investigation. If they had found that the man who exposed Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union had just gotten his arm blown off, it would have called a lot of attention to how did this happen and where and why. 2 days after the assassination, the FBI was at the same facility, which is the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, looking for evidence of Oswald because they had found ID cards on him, which were issued from that facility, smallpox vaccination cards. So the more you get into this, the more you realize that there are very serious connections between medicine and politics in New Orleans that have something to do with Oswald. And in the book, I publish a map that shows that this facility and Dr. Alton Ochsner's house and Mary Sherman's residence and Lee Harvey Oswald's apartment are all within about a mile of each other, which is an awfully big coincidence, and I think begs a lot of questions. And really the key question here, and this goes back to David Ferry, and it eventually gets to people like Guy Bannister, the question is, why would a internationally respected cancer researcher be involved in some project with a violent political extremist like David Ferry? And that's a question that I think deserves a lot of thought.
Well, if there was a mutual interest in getting Castro, and this was all tied into that, it does explain a few things coming together. It doesn't really explain how things jump over to Lee Harvey Oswald being involved in the Kennedy assassination directly or through being framed at, is not the question, but just...
Or they were all working for the same group or agency.
Yeah, and then people were pulled in. It's just a very muddy bunch of water, and I appreciate you taking the time to give us a little bit of clarity in this area, because you get into some areas here that don't really get covered. There's been a lot of people that have looked into so many of the long tentacles of the assassination, and I don't think I've really seen anything come together this way. You've talked in your book about a major lab that Ferry was running. We're talking a couple thousand mice. And that's not something that you just have in your kitchen. That's a huge project and requires sustenance. But maybe you could just, before I get ahead a little bit too far, I found it interesting how you found this place. Maybe you could just let our listeners know a little bit.
Even before that, is your book available right now? Is there somewhere where people can get this?
Yes, they can send me a check and I'll send them a book.
Okay, we'll make a link posted by our interview then.
With respect to my sort of a question before, where was dropping off here?
You were asking about the laboratory.
The mice. How did you actually come across that information?
Well, first of all, back in 1967, Jim Garrison did an interview with Playboy magazine. And in that, he was asked some questions having to do with Jack Ruby dying of cancer. And he said, well, I can't prove that one way or the other, but we have found that this doctor in New Orleans who was hacked to death was working with David Ferry and several other New Orleans doctors. They had this laboratory with about 2,000 mice in it. Well, it just turned out by coincidence that about 5 years later, when I went to Tulane University, I met a girl, became my girlfriend. She lived in an apartment on Louisiana Avenue Parkway. And I was over at her apartment frequently, and we talked about the apartment and how she found it and all this stuff. It turned out the apartment was right across the street from David Ferry's apartment, which I did not know at the time. But when I got into researching this and I discovered where David Ferry's address was, and I looked it up, I realized that it was that other apartment that these attorneys controlled across the street from hers. And when she moved into her apartment, the apartment had been off the market for 5 years. It had been completely repainted, the floors completely redone, and it still had a residual odor. And when we got into what was the odor about, it turned out that the previous tenant had many, many animals in the apartment. And when we got finished with it, it turns out that this apartment was connected and controlled by the same people that controlled David Ferry's apartment. So there was obviously a connection between these two apartments. And the claim of 2,000 animals, 2,000 mice, if you think that through, you say 4 mice per cage, that's 500 cages of mice. Well, there was nothing in David Ferry's apartment on that dimension, but this place across the street, which had other problems with it, was the likely location of that laboratory that Garrison was referencing.
So that's a pretty nice bit of synchronicity to experience. I guess, I mean, you're living in New Orleans. It's not like finding a needle in a haystack in New York, but still, it's pretty interesting.
World's largest small town.
yeah, really. It seems that way. So you've found what you have good reason to feel is the actual lab where this work was going on. You've found people that have basically corroborated that there was a lab there, as in were able to describe it, or it was in records somehow. How are you able to confirm?
Well, it's very interesting. The detail of all this is carefully explained in the book, and one of the things I point out in the book is we're not investigating where the pharmacy was, 30 years ago. We're investigating a super secret operation that was being run by a guy who had one hand in the CIA and another hand in the mafia, okay? This is a very underground thing, and people don't leave a lot of evidence around. One major researcher told me once, and he's a friend of mine, he said, Ed, all you need now is a witness who was there, who saw it all happen. And at the time, I didn't have one. When I published the book, I published the book in 95, that's 10 years ago. And since then, somebody has come forward and said that she was there, and that she was there with David Ferry, and she was there with Lee Harvey Oswald, and that she was doing cancer research in David, or cancer experiments in David Ferry's apartment. And that is Judith Ferry Baker.
Now, this is interesting because, from what I understand, you ran into a Judith Ferry Baker, or somebody claiming to be her, years prior to actually having this confirmed that there was a Judith Ferry Baker working in there, correct?
In New Orleans, in the fall of 1972, I was introduced to a woman, and I was told her name was Judith Ferry Baker, and I was told that she was a close personal friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's. This woman, I can guarantee you, is not the same woman as the one we now know to be Judith Ferry Baker that you interviewed on your radio show recently.
Now, in what context did you meet her? How has this woman materialized in front of you? And have you been able to explain or rationalize this discrepancy in persons?
Well, what happened, and I'll try to keep this brief because I could do a 20-minute version of this, but when I was at Tulane University, I was with my girlfriend. I got into a argument one day in the University Center with some people concerning what is now described as the Ferry Sherman Lab in the books, about all this underground stuff with the monkey viruses and the research. Several days later, I was invited to a party, and it was clear that the invitation to this party had something to do with this conversation that I had, and my girlfriend did not want me talking about this stuff anymore because I was alienating her fellow graduate students. And I had to promise that if I went to this party, that I was not going to shoot off my mouth about all this stuff. So we go to this party, and right before we go inside, I ask her, I said, well, I'd like to know the name of the host or hostess of this party, because, I'm from New Orleans, and I know what the rules of society are, and I'd like to be able to, be polite to the hostess and thank her and all that stuff. And she tells me very clearly that the woman's name is Judith Ferry Baker. So we go on in there, and I meet this woman, and this party is basically set up as a bunch of female graduate students who are networking. They're allowed to bring their spouses or significant others, but everybody, the males all understand they have a secondary role to play at this party. And I spend most of my time in the party with the husband of this woman described to me as Judith Ferry Baker, and the child that they had. But I did have some conversations with her directly. She told me a lot of the same things about her being from a small town in Florida and stuff like that. And then the women were out on the porch drinking wine and stuff, and my girlfriend came in and she was rather startled by something, and she said, "Ed, they're talking about all that stuff you were talking about the other day in the university center." And I'm thinking, great, you know, I promised that I wasn't going to talk about this at this party, and now I'm surrounded by a bunch of inebriated feminists who are getting into the subject, and all I have to do is stay out of it. And then Barbara says, she says, "And they say that Judith knows Oswald, or knew Oswald." I said, "Oh, this is great, you know. Here's the subject I'm trying to stay out of, and somebody is throwing information at me like this." And then this Judith woman walks in the kitchen, and Barbara heads out the room and says, "I understand you're interested in the Garrison investigation." I kind of nod at her, and she says, "Is this something that you'd like to talk about?" And I said, "No, it's not." And I went and got Barbara, and I said, "Look, you asked me not to talk about this, and I'm very distrustful and suspicious about this thing being a setup for some reason. And I don't know who or why, but all my lights are on, and I want to get out of here." And she said, "Well, that's fair. I asked you not to talk about it, and I don't see how we can stay without you talking about it, so let's go." And then a couple weeks later, we got an invitation from this gal for us to come over just as a couple for dinner. And I said, "Is this the woman that said she knew Oswald?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I don't want to go have dinner with a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, if that's okay with you, you know." And that was the last I heard of it. But I'm absolutely positive of the name. And one of the reasons I'm so positive of the name is before the current Judith Berry Baker showed up, I was sitting in an office, and there was a plaque on somebody's door and said the name was Judy Baker, and I just remembered this whole incident. And, you know, I said, "Well, I didn't put this in the book because I don't, you know, assume that everything that happened fits into some kind of puzzle, but it certainly was a weird situation." Then one day, several years later, I get a phone call from people saying they're with 60 Minutes, and they're investigating this woman who said that she was in this laboratory I wrote about in my book and says that she knew Lee Harvey Oswald. And I said, "Well, why don't you send me something in writing on it?" And when they finally sent me something in writing on it, I was reading, and I saw her name. I said, "I know this woman," and I assumed it was the same person. And I called her up and said, "I remember you. I had dinner at your house in New Orleans." And she said, "When was that?" I said, 1972. She said, "I wasn't there in 1972. And I said, "Well, now we have a real serious disconnect here. We've got two different people using the same name, both saying they're friends of Lee Harvey Oswald, who obviously aren't the same person. So one of them is an imposter." And it took me a while to sort out which one, because I wasn't necessarily buying into the one that 60 Minutes showed up with. But now that I know her better, and I know her story, and I've seen her documentation and everything else, it's pretty clear to me that she's the real one. Now, who was the other one, and why was I presented with this information, and who was behind it? I can't tell you. I can't tell you because I don't know.
Well, it sounds like somebody knew that you were interested in the subject and was just on a fishing expedition to see if you were serious.
And I think that's a pretty reasonable read on it, and that's Jim Mars's take on it, and because I've discussed it at length with him. It's just, what I can't tell you is, who was that Garrison behind it trying to give me information so I had the right names, or was that somebody from Army Intelligence who was trying to throw me off? And one of the things that, you know, it's a classic spook move, is to confuse people's identities. I mean, even to the point where the soldiers in World War II, they used to change their badges. So when they got captured by the Germans or the enemy, that it would confuse their intelligence operations about who they are. Now, if I had taken the position when the new Judith Berry Baker showed up that she was the imposter, because I knew the real Judith Berry Baker, then that would have blown her credibility from the beginning, which is very interesting, because that would be a very interesting thing to happen, to cause confusion and distrust and to prevent her from being able to show up and tell her story. But these are conjectures. I don't know who was behind the thing, but I do know positively and absolutely that I was introduced to somebody named Judith Berry Baker in 1972 in New Orleans. Well, and I just cannot believe it wasn't some kind of intelligence operation, because I don't know how those things would line up otherwise.
I can see you're wanting to put all the cards on the table and wondering if, for example, somebody like Garrison could be behind it. But the person who would have the resources to pull something like that off, that sounds like an intelligence type thing for sure.
Yeah, it could have been Ochsner, for that matter. He was still alive at the time. I mean, but I don't know who was. There's a lot of people you could guess at.
Well, it does make you scratch your head, though. I wonder if we could just backstep a little bit, because I know that your reason for getting interested in this subject was really because of AIDS, the AIDS epidemic, and you had expressed that perhaps you had come across some important information that were keys to this, and maybe I'm wondering if this is a sense of moral responsibility that this had to be dug out.
Well, I writing this book was the most difficult thing I've ever done, okay? And as far as I'm concerned, I risked my life to do it, and I only did that because I thought the information in it was that important. And I did start it due to the AIDS issue, but what the real clincher for me about when I came to the go-no-go decision about this was the contamination of the cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine that I write about, because the contamination of the polio vaccine with a cancer-causing monkey virus is the biggest mistake in the history of government, because they didn't realize that there was a cancer-causing virus in the vaccine until they had already released 100 million doses.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
And in my opinion, that contamination of the polio vaccine is what is causing the cancer epidemic we are experiencing today.
And I'm afraid I can't disagree with you. We've had some vaccine-related programs on here, and to me it's just frightening the junk that's in the vaccines, how they're made, of course, to be as economically as possible, but it just seems to make sense that the technology doesn't exist yet to screen out all the viruses from a vaccine that's being made using animals.
Well, now on page 7 of my book, I point to a person who was directly involved in monkey virus research in the 1960s, who warned his fellow colleagues that fooling around with monkey viruses in vaccine could create a new disease which would be unstoppable by current medical standards. And that, in my opinion, is a prediction of the AIDS epidemic, because that's what it is.
Yeah, I guess my concern with the AIDS epidemic is that there are little clues that suggest that perhaps it's not all as accidental, that as far as that one being released into the gay community, blind school, was it a deaf school in New York? The tracks of this have bear the mark of irresponsibility. I know Colonel Prouty actually discussed this a little bit, that there were hints that this disease was being very conveniently herded into certain areas, and it's frightening when you think about the implications of that, because we could be having people making those types of decisions who have no concept of the permanent damage to the human gene pool.
Yeah, it's now, the human blood supply is now permanently contaminated with all kinds of monkey viruses due to these vaccine programs. The thing that I would like to focus on the AIDS thing for a second, first of all, I want to say I think the point of whether or not AIDS, the origin of AIDS, connects to this laboratory in New Orleans is simply an unprovable point. You cannot prove it. They did it, and you cannot prove they didn't do it, because we don't have any evidence on it. But there's a lot of misinformation out there on AIDS, and it would take me a long time to go through it. But the key point that the misinformation evolves around or revolves around is whether or not it's a man-made activity or a natural occurring activity, and what year it first occurs. And the most telling thing that I have seen was a statement made by the people up at Los Alamos laboratories that track the DNA of AIDS. And every time a virus makes anytime anything that's alive makes a copy of itself, the copy is not quite perfect. There's always a little bit of difference in the information between one generation and the next generation. They call that the intrinsic error frequency rate. Now, they measure and map this rate on all kind of animals and viruses and everything else. They know what a normal variation is. You might call that normal variation nature. Now, all of a sudden, along comes HIV-1, and its variation is outside the envelope. Now, you only have two options at that point. You can either redefine the envelope called nature in order to include this one virus, or you have to call the virus unnatural.
And that's a very interesting point. So it really ties into something that I was just hearing, which is indirectly related, but supposedly the gene has been discovered for aging or to turn off aging. And by the same token, if that kind of research has been going on for a while, it makes sense that it would be possible to affect the gene of a cancer-inducing agent or a cancer-causing virus so that it wouldn't burn itself out too quickly before it finished doing its thing.
Yeah, the major cancer-causing virus that I talk about in the book is not AIDS. It does not have to do with AIDS. It is a virus called SV40.
Yeah.
And the S stands for simian, which is the technical term for monkey, V for virus, and 40, just to remind you that they had already discovered 39 other ones in the polio vaccine before they got to that one. And that virus is now very well studied. There are a lot of reports published in magazines like Oncogene or Oncology, and a lot of research coming out of the National Institutes of Health on this. And the major DNA experts involved in this describe SV40 as the most carcinogenic virus ever discovered. And that's the virus that was in the polio vaccine. And that, the question there is, what did the government do once they realized that they had already released 100 million doses of the polio vaccine that was contaminated with SV40? What I think they did was they went to work really quickly on what amounts to a medical Manhattan Project, because they wanted to find a vaccine to stop that virus before the public found out about the problem. And this makes it the biggest skeleton in the political closet in the history of certainly the United States, and maybe more than that.
Well, it makes sense that the initial release it would be accidental, because the people working on vaccines, they had very noble intentions. But when you embark on something of such a large scale, if something does go wrong, the repercussions are terrible. And now think about the flu vaccine, which has been pulled off the U.S. markets, for example. What if there was a contaminated vaccine that caused everybody to die 30 days after getting it? How long would it take before the brakes are put on? I mean, that's a pretty scary, hairy, scenario. But the point being is, if we don't know what new viruses are coming up at any given time, there could be a ticking time bomb going off with these things. And what you're pointing out here, I guess there's not really much consolation even for people who don't get vaccinated, because once it's in the species, so to speak, we're transmitting these things, however.
It is sexually transmitted. In Italy, University of Ferrara did a study that found the SV40 virus in the semen of 45% of the otherwise healthy Italian males.
That doesn't bode very well.
No. This is a very serious public health issue. I mean, one of the things I have, you know, one of my hands is a friendship with the JFK community. Another hand is a distance from them, because my basic position is the contamination of the polio vaccine is a much bigger problem than who shot President Kennedy. Now, the fact that there are some issues that may overlap and may help us understand how people like Lee Harvey Oswald showed up in New Orleans one day and happened to get his apartment right around the corner from where the radioactive equipment was located might help both people, both groups, understand it. But, you know, recently I saw a note on the internet where somebody said, well, Haslam didn't say anything important in the first 30 pages of his book was because I didn't get to talking about recognizable characters from the JFK thing until about page 30. That just means the person thought the only thing that was of interest in this thing was the JFK angle of it. JFK is part of it, but the issue of what did the government do once they realized they had already contaminated the human blood supply with this thing because of their well-intentioned but hasty release of the polio vaccine. You know, polio is a bad disease, and I go into that in the book. But there's a lot of things people don't understand about it. Like, if even back at the height of the polio vaccine, you exposed polio epidemic, you exposed 100 kids to the polio virus, 95 of them showed no symptoms at all, 4 of them got flu-like symptoms, and 1 of them got polio. And today, we now have 15 cases of cancer for every 1 case of polio we used to have. So and these cancers I'm talking about are all soft tissue cancers, and they all pop out of the statistics. I have graphs in the book that show which ones they are and how much they increase. And that epidemic is the one that Bernice Eddy from the National Institutes of Health tried to warn us about when she went public with the knowledge, with the information that there was a problem with the polio vaccine.
Well, what did you say her name was?
Bernice Eddy, E-D-D-Y. The graph's on about page 103 of the book.
Okay.
And as far as I'm concerned, the soft tissue cancer epidemic that we are seeing today, which is very clear in the statistics, is Eddie's epidemic. It is the one that she tried to warn us about. And this woman was an MD, PhD. She was in charge of safety for the polio vaccine. Okay, she was the senior officer of the National Institute of Health. And she went public right before the Nixon-Kennedy election to say that there's a problem on this. There were no whistleblower laws to protect her or anything else. She just rolled the dice, went to the American Cancer Annual Convention, gave a speech, and said there's a problem.
Now, we have to take that, go back to the era that she was in, where there were efforts being made to stop polio, and this is a new science, versus now where drug companies are so powerful, it's a cutthroat, competitive business, and when it comes right down to it, it's about profits, 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 and cutting corners.
Well, back then, the situation back then was this. It was politics, right? FDR was president for 16 years. He had polio. Because he had polio, you had all kind of people, like the March of Dimes, drumming up efforts to stop polio. And when the Democrats passed the torch to the Republicans continued those efforts. So by the time the polio vaccine got around to being released, it had everybody's fingerprints over it. It had the Democrats and the Republicans, because they were at the switch at the time. It was Dwight Eisenhower was the president. He was fighting the Cold War. Richard Nixon was basically running the domestic stuff. And a lot of people don't realize this, but the first time they released the polio vaccine, it backfired, and there was a problem. And they withdrew the polio vaccine from the market. They fired the director of the National Institute of Health and just about everybody that had anything to do with them. Then Nixon was given the responsibility of reorganizing the National Institute of Health and getting the polio vaccine back on track. That's when they switched from the Salk vaccine to the Sabin vaccine. And all this was done in the mid-1950s during the Eisenhower-Nixon administration. So what that means, I mean, just to really put a finger on it, that means that Richard Nixon was holding the political roses on the contamination of the polio vaccine, and that he was in a position of realizing that if the public found out about it, it would destroy him.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, and I think that even nowadays it's happening that people get a second set of eyelids if they think that they might be personally implicated for being responsible for something. And if in that kind of situation, what do you do? You can't take it back. You've already given it out.
Well, it's interesting that more recently they've been giving the drug companies amnesty in advance, immunity from legal prosecution.
I know, and that's really worrying, because even now the National Vaccine Injury Program has got huge backlogs of people who aren't being compensated for the same reason, basically because there's so much protection for the drug companies. And I find it interesting, this latest round with the flu vaccine, it didn't surprise me at all, unfortunately, that Bush did use this as an excuse to secure more rights for the drug companies not to be sued. Really sad day, because the lack of responsibility that's being exercised with these things is tremendous. We've interviewed Professor Garth Nicholson here and also Mr. Donald Scott, and they've got a lot to say about vaccines, how they're made, and some of the problems with them. And it's not just being fervent and trying to get your product out. It's downright monstrous. At one point, we could say, even back in the day of Nixon, these guys were trying to cover up something that had happened. But these guys are trying to cover up something that is happening and going to happen.
Yeah, well, that's because they learned their lesson. I mean, I hate to put it so bluntly, but they know about the problems. And Garth Nicholson is a guy who I have a great deal of respect for. I know what he's done with the Gulf War syndrome things, and he's well qualified to talk about a lot of that stuff. In fact, people say things like he wrote the book on cancer. Well, Garth Nicholson wrote the textbook called Cancer and Metastasis, which is used in the medical schools across the country.
Yeah, he's one of the most published doctors out there, and very, very respectable, and refreshingly one of the few that's working for an independent lab that it's private, and they're doing research for the sake of doing research, not so that some big multinational corporation can, you know, take it away. And I think they're not totally against vaccines. They're looking for ways to do it safely.
Yeah, on the political side of this, one of the things I did not put in the book that I think would be of interest to your audience is that Lyndon Johnson one day decided to jump in his limousine, rush over to the Pentagon for an unannounced meeting, and came out of the Pentagon, got back in the limousine, and went over to Arlington Cemetery and stood at Jack Kennedy's grave. The date this happened was July 21st, 1964, the same day Mary Sherman's murder was known.
Well, that's odd. That is odd. It just makes you wonder a little bit.
Well, it's interesting timing.
Now, I wonder if we could actually step back to your book for a bit, too. You had a very interesting experience due largely to your personal expertise, and you actually had a chance to look at Guy Bannister's records.
Yeah.
Could
it's
you tell
an unusual story,
okay.
like many of my stories are, but I was working at an ad agency in New Orleans, and I was asked to go as a business favor over to check out an operation to see if there was anything we could do to help them. This is a very routine sort of request that's made of ad agencies all the time, and particularly in a place in, like New Orleans, where the business community is very tightly knit. I had recently finished my work in graduate school in Latin American studies, and Latin America was of big interest to these people because where I was invited was the offices of INCA, which was the Information Council on the Americas, which was the anti-communist propaganda mill financed and founded by Dr. Alton Ochsner. And I was shown these files, and it was explained to me at the time that the indexing system was missing. And as I looked through the files just briefly, all the files were organized by numbers, and you couldn't figure out what was in what without the index, just a standard FBI indexing system. And I was told at the time that the Guy Bannister, and I was asked if I would be willing to spend some time and try to straighten out the files and rebuild the indexing system because they were sure there was a lot of important information in there. I turned down the assignment, but I remembered where I was, and when I got into this project later, and I realized that INCA was a organ of Dr. Ochsner, and realized that they were in possession of Guy Bannister's files, that was evidence of a very serious medical political connection right at the heart of the city where the Justice Department raided an effort to assassinate Castro on August 30th, 1963, which, in my opinion, was the great accomplishment of Lee Oswald in New Orleans because he helped them identify the location of that, which was a camp that Bannister was running.
So, to get this right, Oswald provided information that got Bannister's camp busted, so to speak. But Bannister and Oswald kind of, was this like a double agent relationship, you think?
Let me say, I'm going to give you kind of the long answer on this. When I wrote Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, I took the position, just for the book, that I didn't know who Lee Harvey Oswald was other than the fact that he was accused of assassinating Kennedy, and it did not matter to me whether or not he had killed Kennedy or he had been framed, because it didn't really change the dynamics of what happened in New Orleans that summer before. Okay. Since then, I have read a lot of stuff, and I've thought about it, and I've thought about things that were told to me back in New Orleans then, and it is pretty clear to me that Oswald was some kind of undercover agent that was penetrating the operations in New Orleans for somebody. And I personally think that has a lot to do with how he got back in the country when he did.
Okay, because it would be interesting if he had actually turned on Bannister, as opposed to if Bannister had him running different errands, because there's so many layers to this, it's really hard to really know whether you're coming or going.
That's what moles do. They don't go in and bust the place. They go in and find out what's happening and pass the information back to somebody else who comes in and busts the place.
Exactly, yeah.
And what happens is, shortly after Oswald is in Bannister's office and sees all this stuff going on, it's within 2 weeks of that the camp across the lake gets raided. And then Oswald's finished, and so he leaves.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I'm saying, so what you see is this situation with, he comes into town, gets his apartment right next to this place where the radioactive equipment is, where they're trying to develop the vaccine. But the thing is, this is all secret because Nixon didn't want Kennedy to know. So they hid all the money. So what happens is Kennedy comes in and discovers that the CIA is missing hundreds of millions of dollars. And they don't know what they did with it. So he puts Bobby in charge and says, figure it out. So Oswald comes into town, happens, you know who Adele Edison is?
Refresh us here.
Adele Edison is today a professor of neurology at a university in Texas.
Okay.
In 1963, she was a postdoc neurology graduate student operating out of the LSU Medical School. She had, and this story was reported by her to ARB, and there's a 21-page brief in the ARB files if anybody wants to know it. At any rate, the key piece of information as it relates to what I'm saying is that Adele Edison was given a telephone number about 2 weeks before Oswald moved to New Orleans, was given Oswald's name, was asked to contact him, which she did, and she spoke to him on the telephone. Now, if you know anything about where Oswald lived on Magazine Street, he lived in a little apartment in the back, just a little one-room apartment, and he did not have a telephone, but his landlord had a telephone. And so when he wanted to use the telephone, he used his landlord's telephone. So somebody knew where Oswald was going to be living before he moved to New Orleans. I think that's very interesting, particularly since where he was living was right down the street from the most secret laboratory in the entire country.
Yeah, very interesting. The little pieces sort of, yeah, it makes you scratch your head a bit more. Well, okay, so that does indicate that there was somebody, and this wasn't just any old person calling him, as you said, somebody
with this was a director of the National Institute of Health, a colonel from the United States Army who had been involved in MacArthur's laboratories in Japan, and who was an expert in bioweapons.
So you think that that he had possibly Oswald, and this is, of course, very conjecturous, working as an agent to penetrate this to uncover this secret lab?
No, not him. Somebody else did. He was trying to figure out what Oswald was doing.
Okay.
This is watchers watching watchers. But the key point about Adele's thing is not to is just to understand that somebody knew where he was going to be, whether they knew it because they had wiretapped somebody else, whether they had overheard a conversation. I mean, it doesn't mean because they knew that they are the ones who arranged it. But Adele is very clear about the fact that she had what amounts to Lee Harvey Oswald's telephone number 2 weeks before he moved to New Orleans, before he claims to even know where he was going to live.
Yeah, well, that's significant.
And that's Edison, E-D-I-S-E-N.
Okay, E-N, right.
For those who want to check it out.
Now, are there any other facts here that you would like to point out in your book that you think that people don't really know enough about that might be of interest that they should focus on?
Well, the general point that I try to make is that it was once told to me by a teacher that I had who I write about in the book. She's the woman in the last chapter. I call her Mama Judge because she had three sons who were judges, and she was terribly well informed about what was going on. And she had she talked to us one day in the class, and this was when the Warren Commission was still in session, and she told us that the Warren Commission was going to come to the conclusion that Lee Oswald had acted alone. And this was before they had announced that. And we thought that was of interest, and we said, why? And she said, well, because they don't want to get into who Lee Oswald really is and who he was working for.
Huh.
And, you know, so we said, you know, well, who is he and who is he working for? The obvious question. But the reason they didn't want to get into it, because there was another subject that if they really got into that, there was another subject down there that was worse than killing the president. And that subject was the contamination of the polio vaccine. And if they had really understood that Lee Oswald was a undercover agent working for people very close to the top of the U.S. government, and that he was in there trying to figure out what had happened with all that money that was missing from the CIA budget from the Nixon administration, then he would not have looked like a lone nut.
Yeah. On page 76, you've got an interesting chart here that really shows how Inca ties in with everything. And I think that that's one of the things I really appreciate about your book is that, and it's been a couple months since I've gone through it, so if I seem a little rustic, I'm really bad with details, even, you know, 2 days after I've read something. But this did stand out in my head, that this organization really could bear some serious scrutiny.
Well, and what the chart you're looking at shows, and the way I present it there, is that these familiar names to everybody in the JFK circle, people like Riley Coffee Company and Guy Bannister and David Ferry and Mary Sherman, were completely surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald. But if I was to explain that to you today, I would say it's exactly the opposite. It's Oswald is in the middle of all of them, because they were all connected prior to him showing up. And he did what a mole does. He got in the middle of them.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Very interesting stuff. I have to recommend to people to get this book because it takes you on a totally different perspective of how the whole thing came together. And I do agree with you when it comes to this monkey virus. This is really, really comes down to what our issues are today. It's important to understand what happened in the Kennedy assassination, and I think it's really important for history's sake to know about the people around it. And I think we would all it would do us some good to recognize who Judy Baker is, because this is a woman with some natural talents, and I think she could still contribute, if she was given an opportunity to do so. But when we talk about contaminating, you know, 100 million people with a polio virus, I mean, I know my father had one of those cancers that is on that list, and it's frightening when you think about the repercussions. It just doesn't seem to go away, this stuff. It just
Well, let's ask the question on that. Why were you using radiation in order to mutate a monkey virus? You know, that is the question that they did not want asked. That is why this whole Medical Manhattan Project was a secret. They didn't want to get into why they were willing to do something that was that risky in order to fix a problem that the public didn't know they had yet. That's why this whole thing, and that's why I describe it as the Medical Manhattan Project.
So you think they were actually using radiation to try and turn around this epidemic that they created, and similarly were looking for a way to get castor with all one big lump, or?
No, I think there was the front door to the project and the back door to the project. The front door, the real reason for why there was a linear particle accelerator located on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, was that they were trying to create a strain of SV40 that could be used in a vaccine. If I can take just a second to go back to the polio vaccine. When Salk tried the Salk vaccine, there were three strains of polio. Let's call them deadly, medium, and benign. Okay, Salk took the deadly strain, drowned it in embalming fluid to kill it, and then said, now we're going to inject people with the dead vaccine. Their immune system, it won't cause any disease because it's dead, but their immune system will recognize that it doesn't belong here. It will trigger the immune response, and people will develop an immunity to this dead vaccine. The problem was, when they released the Salk vaccine, it didn't kill all of it. And children, even Dr. Ochsner's grandchildren, he publicly inoculated them with this, with Salk's vaccine. One of them died, the other one got polio. Okay? That strategy backfired. So when they took it off the market and they went back to the second strategy, which was Albert Sabin's strategy, they said, okay, we're going to use the weak strain, the benign strain, because that doesn't really make people sick enough to cripple them. And we're going to give them a very limited amount of this weak strain. And that was the sugar cube. And that was the successful polio vaccine. Okay? When they went to deal with SV40, they said, the problem is we don't have three strains to choose from. We only have one strain. We need to make it change. We need to accelerate the rate at which it changes. We need to expose it to radiation in order to try to find a benign, a weak strain of it that we can use as a basis for the vaccine. So that we can do something about all these people we've already inoculated with cancer-causing viruses.
So then the hope being that the weak strain, once it's in the body with the virulent strain, will eventually reduce the virulent strain.
Well, what it does is it gives the immune system the opportunity to develop an immune response to the weak strain, and that immune response also works with the strong strain.
Right, okay.
Okay, so it's like tricking the body. But the, you know, it was a dangerous trick, you know, and that's, you know, my take on what's going on there. And so once they, the other problem with this is back then you couldn't isolate one virus out of there. You take a blood sample and you know that you got the bad virus in the blood sample. You got other stuff in the blood sample.
Yeah.
You know?
And then, so then how do they know then if they are successfully mutating one strain down, they might be mutating another one up?
That's right. They could create more disease instead of creating less disease. They could create a super virus that nothing can stop, which is what HIV-1 is.
Yeah. Well, I guess in the end, we just have to make sure that we're staying as healthy as possible. I don't know that you don't want to refuse a vaccine, though, if it's going to fix your problems. But I don't, in the end, trust anybody to get that stuff right anyways.
Yeah.
At least not until they come out in the open about the whole works and let everybody see exactly what's going on. Because otherwise, how do you know that somebody hasn't decided, well, maybe we've got too many people on this planet anyways, so maybe it's not such a bad thing that all these people die.
Well, that's certainly one of the agendas that you have to spend some time thinking about, because we're talking about a permanent change in the population of the planet. I mean, there's now, you know, 100 million people with AIDS, or, you know, dead or dying, and frankly, there's no end in sight.
I just wonder, because we have kept you over an hour, but I wonder if we could just go back a little bit, because your book is Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. I know we've talked about Mary. We haven't really said much about Ferry. Is there any new insights on him that perhaps people wouldn't be aware of who haven't read your book?
Well, the perspective on David Ferry from people who are good, educated JFK researchers was always that he was kind of a loose cannon, who maybe had some skill here and there, but he didn't have his hands on anything that was really, really dangerous. Okay, and the researchers who were aware of this Mary Sherman claim, because she was always on the list of suspicious deaths, figured that she probably wasn't much, because why would you know, a doctor be involved with a bunch of homebrew cancer experiments with a lunatic fringe person like Ferry. When you realize that Mary Sherman was not a second-class doctor, but she was an internationally respected cancer researcher who ran the cancer lab at Dr. Ochsner's hospital, then you got to ask different types of questions about David Ferry. And my kind of bottom line on this is, if there was ever a situation where somebody left a destructive instrument in the hands of a dangerous man, it was this with David Ferry. And, you know, Judith Baker, I have not heard the interview she did with you, but she says day after day she went to David Ferry's apartment and got the mice. Somebody brought him in. She cut out the cancers. They ground them up. They made a sauce. They put it in petri dishes. They figured out which one was going to grow cancer the fastest, and they passed the information on. Now, that is an awfully dangerous scenario. That is somebody deliberately trying to develop a biological weapon to kill somebody. And in this case, the target, according to Judith, was Fidel Castro.
Yeah. Of course, Judith would have been told what she was told, and she, just like anybody else, wouldn't have any way of knowing what would be used with the final data.
That's right. And Judith was heavily manipulated in this situation. And, you know, she's worth listening to, but she will tell you herself, all she can do is tell you what she thought she knew at the time.
Exactly. Yeah, and she was quite young. And it must have seemed like quite an interesting call, too, to be asked to research something like this, because your country's got weapons aimed at it, and probably it would ring the patriotic bells pretty strongly for a lot of people to answer that kind of call. And I think most people, maybe even today, might be a little bit naive about how something like that could be used in the wrong hands.
Right.
It's not that she didn't have the intelligence to know, but I mean, it's kind of like, gosh, who would do such a thing as to turn something loose on society irresponsibly? But clearly,
well, there are people who understand the risk and people who don't fully get it. You know, at the time she was young, you know, if you're going to discuss anything during the Cold War, you got to understand Cold War mentality. She had friends from high school who were the children of Batista ministers from Cuba, whose, you know, parents had been run out of the country, whose friends had been captured and tortured and executed and everything else. One should never underestimate how the Cuban refugee community feels about Fidel Castro. And, you know.
Yeah, fair enough.
Any project to kill Fidel Castro from the New Orleans business point of view was a winkable offense.
Yeah. So now you've got this book done. Any more plans in this direction, or have you just kind of moved on and you're working on other things?
Well, the only other thing that I think is really important, as anyone listening to this has quickly come to the conclusion, that this is a fairly complicated subject. And to streamline the subject so that it's more understandable to people and more digestible, and where people realize that, you know, this was good intentions gone bad and things like that, I have written a full-length screenplay for it. And books and screenplays are very different creatures, because you can get into the web of complexity in a book in a way that you cannot do in a screenplay. Screenplays have to be very action-oriented, move down the line. But I have finished a screenplay for it. So the thing that I would like to see happen next on this is some sort of movie on it.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great. Hopefully it gets picked up.
Right. I've also done, you know, some on-camera interviews, long, in-depth ones, that are in various stages of coming to be. And, you know, I don't control those because the producers control them. But I've already said what I have to say about the subject in those interviews, and it's very similar to what I've said here, but it is an on-camera thing. So those things may be coming out. at some point. Mostly I have, you know, moved on with my life, but and this book is now 10 years old. The reasons I put it in the book was so that it would be there forever for anybody to take a look at. And I think, I really, really think this is a subject people knowing about, either from the JFK point of view or from the non-JFK point of view. It's just, it's the contamination of the human blood supply with cancer-causing viruses is too big of an issue to ignore, in my opinion.
Yeah, I fully agree. And actually, Len's been just saying this lately. He wants to do another program on vaccines, which kind of, this kind of qualifies in that, because it is a very serious issue, and we can talk about what's going on now, but what's happened in the past is with us today, and the cancer rate is through the roof.
It is, and that's something that is not adequately reported or described in the media. And that's why I put those graphs in the book, so you could see the graphs for yourself. And this is not, one of the things when I finally understood the warning that Bernice Eddy had given us, that there will be an epidemic of cancer, I said, well, this is not a subject I want a marginal issue on. I mean, I'm going to go look at the cancer statistics, and if this is not a clear, glaring, obvious thing, I'm not going to get into it. And when I got there and I saw how dramatic and obvious the problem was, and it's four soft tissue cancers, and they are breast, prostate, melanoma, and lymphoma. Those four pop out of the statistics like, a firework on the 4th of July. It is so obvious. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was this data, and I have it in the appendix of the book, covers 16 years, and I actually photocopied the actual NIH document or an NCI document so people could see it, okay? I said, well, that's from, you know, like this year to that year. Let me go back and get some more recent information. And I went back, and I asked the same librarian who had given this to me, and she said, oh, yeah, I got a new book. And she went back, and they do not publish the same information anymore. I mean, the news is so bad, they literally don't publish the answer.
And I'd laugh because, you know, I remember the days when there was talk about the Russians pulling pages out of textbooks and whatnot. Yeah, well, what's the difference if your history is being selectively omitted? I don't know.
On that point, there's a very, very important point. Do you recall learning when you were young that cancer could not be caused by a virus? That it was some kind of bizarre genetic thing, that it could not be caught or transferred? I remember learning that. Why did they not? And I know that's BS nowadays because you get on the Internet and you start researching what the U.S. government is financing, and you discover they're financing all kinds of research into cancer-causing viruses. But it was very clear that you couldn't make the claim that Jack Ruby was killed by being injected with cancer if you had the underlying idea already established that that's impossible from a scientific point of view.
Yeah, there have only been a couple cases, murder cases, where somebody has been charged with using cancer as a murder weapon. And you'd think, actually, something like that, especially for intelligence community, that's a great way to get rid of somebody, relatively quickly. So it just makes a certain amount of sense as an assassination tool. I know there's a lot of questions about how Jack Ruby could have died so quickly after requesting to speak on, to the Warren Commission. So,
right.
Very, very shady stuff.
Now, do you have any opinion of the demise of David Ferry?
I think there are people who are better equipped to address that.
Fair enough.
The timing of David Ferry's death is obviously suspicious. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. You know, and I've had people like Cyril Wecht say to me that if he was in a court of law, he could prove that David Ferry was murdered. Okay? But there are other people who are good, competent people, like Dr. Chetta, who called it natural causes. So I really just have to say, I don't know, but and that's going to be one of our unanswered questions.
Now, the impression I got from what you had to say about David Ferry, this guy is actually pretty much he was an intellectual among all his weird stuff.
Yes.
So it shouldn't be really a surprise to people who go, what is he doing working with, you know, mice in a cancer lab? But from the sounds of it, I mean, he was a very, very well-educated man, and, you know, not everybody goes to get a pilot's license. So obviously, despite his physical appearance and what some would call a strange lifestyle, he had a lot under his hat.
Yeah, he was not some guy with a pilot's license. He was an Eastern Airline captain on a four-engine jet.
Yeah, that's not a minor one either.
Yeah, I mean, David was he was a very bright guy. He had his own problems, but his problem was not lack of intelligence. You know, he spoke, you know, several languages. You know, I spent an afternoon with Perry Russo, who knew David well. And, you know, all I did was listen and let Perry talk. And I got a really good sense of this guy's intellectual capabilities. And, you know, that's one of the things that made him dangerous, frankly, is, you know, was the combination of his capabilities and his intentions.
Right. Well, is there anything that you would like to add before we wrap up here?
Oh, just that Gerald Posner said that Mary Sherman died in an accidental house fire.
Oh, good. Well, we all know that we have to rush out and buy whatever he has to say.
Well, what's funny to me about that, I mean, obviously, he's completely wrong, and the way he positioned it in the case closed book said that he had seen the medical records, and, you know, he said according to the medical records and all this other stuff. But it was the only place I'd ever run into the idea that her death was accidental. And I really wondered, you know, because Posner has a long history of cooperation with the CIA, and that's a very well-documented thing, and his law partner, who was never in his law office, happened to be working in the White House and all this other stuff. I mean, when you get into who Posner was. But I was really interested with who might have told him that Mary Sherman's death was actually accidental. And I thought that was an interesting point.
You know, it's kind of funny because that might be one of those Freudian things where actually maybe, well, I mean, as you suggested, that it was murder on one level, but maybe it wasn't really meant for her. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't think she was the ultimate target. I think, as I say in the book, that I think she just got caught in a crossfire of political titans. And if Dr. Altnoschner had grabbed that handle instead of her, they never would have been able to cover it up. And it would have blown up front page right in front of the Warren Commission investigation on the day that they were starting to take the testimony in New Orleans. And when you got finished with who was this guy who just got his arm blown off and you discovered he was the guy that exposed Lee Harvey Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union, in quotes, right before the assassination, and they happened to be using radiation on this thing. I mean, by the time the press got finished with that and got some of the answers out, then you just... Lone nut would have been impossible. Lone nut is impossible, then all kind of other stuff happens.
Now a little bit of a question still around Mary Sherman's death, for example. Now, because of the accelerator that you mentioned that she was working on and the high voltage there, is there any way that her arm could have been cut off and then burned after the fact, or the burn was so severe you could tell the arm was burned off? How do you know the difference with something like that? Just curious.
The burn goes from her right hip to the right side of her head. It was so severe that all of the skin, the muscles covering the rib cage itself was destroyed, exposing the internal organs. Now, have you ever burned a hair on your arm when you were cooking? Most of us have.
Yeah.
Why? Because hair is the easiest thing to burn on the human body. And bones are the hardest. In fact, they don't even burn. They dehydrate. So it takes thousands of degrees to destroy a bone and hardly any degrees to burn a hair. And on Mary Sherman's body, they had destroyed bones immediately next to unburned hair. That is a high voltage electrocution.
Okay. Now, just to clear my own thoughts on this a little bit, now, why would somebody want to murder anybody at a time that it could cause problems, for example? I sort of understood what you said earlier, but I don't think I really grasped it because I'm still scratching my head a little bit.
Okay, it goes like this. You got the Warren Commission investigation reviewing the files of the FBI in New Orleans concerning the Kennedy assassination. Right there on top of the stack is a report from two FBI agents who went over to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital looking for evidence of Lee Harvey Oswald because they found the smallpox vaccination card from there issued to him and signed by his alias A.J. Heidel. Now, if you have that information sitting on your desk and you are investigating the murder of the president, and all of a sudden the guy that exposed Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union gets his arm blown off, where? At the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, which happens to be right down the street from Lee Harvey Oswald's apartment, you all of a sudden have a problem.
Okay, but here's where I'm getting lost. Do you think somebody actually wanted this whole thing exposed and then sent him up to actually be electrocuted? Or I think
yes,
I'm missing the...
Yes, yes.
Oh, I see. So you think somebody was trying to expose the whole thing...
To destroy Lone Nut.
Oh, to
take down Johnson.
Okay,
yes.
So you're... All right, now I'm getting it. Because, I mean, I've felt for the longest time, I think there's plenty of evidence that there are factions at war here. They might not be overt about the existence that there would be forces that would have been opposed to Kennedy's assassination. So what you're suggesting is that there may have been a murder set up here that would have been so hard to refute the evidence that it would have brought the whole thing down.
It would have brought the whole thing down.
But she ended up grabbing the thing instead of
Oshner.
Right. Okay.
If you brought the whole thing down and there was a reasonable exposure, you would have taken out LBJ and Richard Nixon.
Well, can I throw an alternate point of view out? And maybe
sure.
You've done more research. Did you have any opinion to think that Mary would be the one, maybe, Mary Farrell would be exposing...
Excuse me, you mean Mary Sherman.
Sherman, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to postulate my question, talking it through, just thinking. I thought, what if you have this scenario that it was meant for the other guy, but really maybe was going to expose this ring and say that they knew Lee Oswald, and when the FBI were coming down, word of her whistleblowing maybe had come out.
That was a theory that was on the table that a lot of people like Donnelly Keith, who interviewed over 100 people in Mary Sherman's murder, felt that she was murdered to shut her up because she knew something. She remembered the assassination of Kennedy was in November of 63, and she dies in July of 64. And it's not what I consider the best explanation. You know, a lot of this stuff is you lay the pieces out on the table, and you arrange them to see if you can get them to fit together and make some sense out of it. So this is an inexact science, because we're guessing about motivation of things that weren't even acknowledged as what really happened. You know, I mean, this thing is, the old riddle inside the enigma thing. But that is certainly a point of view that reasonable people have taken on it. I just don't think it explains the facts as well as some other ones do.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. But others had come to that thought and investigated it. I hadn't heard of that other investigation. So you mentioned he interviewed over 100 people?
Yeah, Don Lee Keith, and he's in the book, and I quote him in there fairly extensively for a couple of pages. He was a newspaper reporter at the major newspaper in New Orleans at the time of Mary Sherman's murder. Don has since died. But over the years, he wrote several articles about this, and somebody put me in contact with him. And he, one of the most interesting things he said was that he was at his desk at the newspaper in New Orleans at 8:45 in the morning, and he was told that there was a lesbian sex slashing in uptown New Orleans that was going to be the big news of the day. But the autopsy on Mary Sherman, which found the 2-centimeter laceration on her genitals, which is what the justification for the slashing was, didn't even start for 15 minutes. Didn't start until 9 o'clock. So the cover story was in place before the autopsy even happened.
Well, that's a pretty significant clue right there. I mean, whenever one of these big murders happens, there's always something that, I mean, even with in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, press releases about who this guy was so soon after the assassination. That's almost like a classic stamp that smells.
Right.
Yeah.
An enormous muscle had to be moved in order to keep this story in place. I mean that's my take on it. The fact, I mean, can you imagine the key fact in this entire thing, the fact that proved she did not die in her apartment was her right arm was missing. That was never once mentioned in public. Never once in any of the newspaper stories that went on for 2 weeks.
Well,
so when you hide the key fact, that is almost by definition what a cover-up is.
And the voltage of a particle accelerator would be one explanation of how something could happen that bad.
That's right. And the way the muscle gets put in place is this is a secret laboratory for the United States government, and we brought this woman back to her apartment and faked the murder scene in order to preserve the secrecy of this laboratory.
Yeah, so it's not too hard to see how you can get willing participants in a cover-up. When people think that they're doing something patriotic, they'll lie for their country. That's not a difficult thing. And
yeah.
It's not even a far-reached for people who really believe that Kennedy was a traitor or bad for their country, for those people to really think that they were doing their country a favor in taking him out. And so I think that when people examine patriotism, it's not really that hard to understand how conspiracies can happen. There's always more than one opinion on how policy should be run anyways.
Well, Reinhard Gehlen, the German general who founded the German intelligence service after the war, said there's a difference between treachery and treason, but the punishment has to be the same.
I can see that. That's interesting quote. So, well, we've kept you for a pretty good long interview here. I hope we're not keeping you from enjoying your Sunday too much. Halloween day being what it is, going to be lots of kids around soon, so I think we're going to have to start winding up.
Okay, well, I'm going to go get out the candy.
Yeah.
Thank you for this opportunity to discuss this subject. I will send you the information on the link in terms of how people can get the book.
Okay, great.
There's a lot of people out there who think the book is out of print because they get told that by places like Amazon and stuff. I print books as I ship them. It's never out of print. It's a completely elastic supply. The only reason Amazon doesn't send them anymore is my position has always been, send me a check, I'll send you a book. And they don't want to send the checks. So.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, you know what? All the more power to people who do stuff independently anyways. You know, So we'll put up a link as soon as you send that over. And thank you so much for taking this time to talk to us. Very, very interesting. And, well, keep us informed about your productions as they come out. We'll let people know.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. You've been joining us here in the studio, Black Hawk Radio, number 195, October 31st, 2004. And you were just listening to Ed Haslam presenting his information on Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. Good book. So we'll put that link up. Thanks again for joining us.
You've been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.